We continue the Easter journey, and we continue reading from the Acts of the Apostles about what happened to the apostles when they ran into the opposition from the Pharisees of the Sanhedrin. So that's a continuation from yesterday, and we'll ponder the intervention of Gamaliel in this first reading. And then in the Gospel, we leap over a couple of chapters. We were in John chapter 3 yesterday, now we're in John chapter 6, and we start a reflection on the bread of life. But that's just basically what we're doing, but I want to keep our eyes open to the fact that we are in the Easter season, and so we read these readings with Easter eyes. One indication of this is from, you can find it at the end of today's first reading, the apostles who suffer flogging think it's great. 2 weeks ago was Good Friday, and that was the low point. That was the, well, seemingly the low point. That was the terrible defeat of the whole project. And the apostles on Good Friday all ran away, except for John. But I mean, basically, they were terrified by the idea of suffering at all. And here it is 2 weeks later. Now, this is not 2 weeks later in time, but 2 weeks later liturgically, and we see the opposite. How does it say? They left the presence of the Sanhedrin, rejoicing that they had been found worthy to suffer dishonor for the sake of the name. Rejoicing that they had been found worthy to suffer. Now that's an Easter perspective, not a natural perspective. And throughout Easter, we'll keep getting this contrast between what's natural human and what's heavenly or the perspective of faith. Okay, so with that in mind, let's look at this intervention of Gamaliel, who introduces an in-between level, because we've been seeing the contrast or the conflict between the apostles and the Pharisees. The Pharisees are caught up in jealousy, first of all, envy, and then also anger. Actually, they're furious. It said that in yesterday's reading, they're furious. So those are two strong passions. In fact, two deadly sins, right? Envy and anger are among the deadly sins. And they're determined to destroy these disobedient fishermen. Gamaliel does not take the faith position. He doesn't say this comes from God, this is something we should follow, this is the way of salvation for us. He takes the reasonable position, which is still good. This is the value of reason when it's used properly. The Pharisees, the rest of the Pharisees, are irrational at this point because they're being consumed by their emotions or their passions. But Gamaliel is taking a reasonable stand and saying, let's just wait and not do anything, because we don't know if this is good or bad. We can't just leap to the conclusion that we have to destroy these people. Maybe this is a human project, and if it is, well, it will just collapse on its own weight, under its own weight. And maybe God's at work here, and you might find yourselves opposing God himself. So Gamaliel isn't saying this is from God. He's saying we just don't know, so let's not be hasty. It's a good position to take. It's not supernatural, but it's still good to use our reason properly. But I like to point out the difference between the rational position, which is Gamaliel here, and the supernatural position. The rational position is, let's just see what comes of it. And he's open to the fact that God could be working in human affairs. That's pretty good. But the examples he gives are of purely human projects. These two men who gathered followers, and when they died, the followers all scattered. Now, Jesus has been dead for at least a couple of months by this time, because this is after Pentecost, so we're talking about the life of the church. And the followers of Jesus are not scattering. They're multiplying by the thousands. I mean, even Pentecost Day itself, there are 3,000 I mean, there are thousands of people who are being influenced by this. So Gamaliel might suspect that this isn't exactly the same as these other two, but he's not going to take the leap of faith. But it's good for us to understand human things, or purely human things, they don't have that. I mean, they might look impressive for a moment, but they don't have that much lasting impact because they are temporal. And a lot of things that we are impressed by or influenced by are purely human, and they might be good as far as they go, but they're just temporal phenomena. What complicates it a little bit, and this is a concern nowadays, is that there's also demonic influence in things that happen, and that's more serious. But still, by comparison to the power of God, it's still basically nothing, even though we're rightly concerned about evil developments in the world. We don't have to be afraid of them because we're being called to live on a supernatural level, the level of faith. Okay, so there's this human, there's this supernatural. I'm leaving aside that demonic influence for now just because it complicates the picture, but and it doesn't ultimately change it, but it does complicate it. So let's turn to this event in the gospel, which is well known as the multiplication of the loaves. Now, John's version of it is a little different if you ever want to study the comparison of the different gospels, but it's a miracle that's recounted in all the gospels, and it had tremendous influence on the early church, both because it proved the power of Jesus to solve human problems like hunger, and it also was a foreshadowing of the Eucharist, which is the great miracle of multiplying food for our spiritual life. So this gospel, now we're reading from John chapter 6 here, this is like a prologue to what we're going to study next week, that is the Bread of Life discourse. So here, he's not talking about the bread of life yet. He's really multiplying loaves, real barley loaves to eat. But it's a good introduction to what we'll be covering next week. Now, I know, and you probably know this too, the common interpretation of this nowadays, or in the last, say, 50 years, is to interpret it as a miracle of sharing. You know this one, right? That the miracle is that people had their food and shared it, and that's why everybody had enough. And that's a pretty common interpretation, and it's used to say, okay, you rich people, you should share with those who don't have, or rich nations should provide food for the hungry nations. And it's a pretty good argument. I mean, yeah, we should those who have more should share with those who have less, and that would make a big dent in the inequalities, the distribution of food around the world. So you can't say it's a bad thing for people to share, but that's not the point of the gospel. I mean, that's the problem with that is that it becomes a human project, and any NGO can say, you know, goodwill, a goodwill among men or among peoples should lead to a greater distribution, a more equal distribution of food. It doesn't take any faith to see that would be just a good thing to do. It doesn't take any kind of anything beyond rationality. Say, people who have a lot of food, more than they can possibly eat, should share with people who don't have enough food. Okay. But that's not the point of this gospel. And you can tell it's not the point because, especially in John's version, here he's not talking about people who are lying faint from hunger because they've been following him for 3 days. That part's not in this version. It's Passover, so that's a significant sign. And Jesus sees the crowd coming toward him, so they're just coming now. And he initiates this idea, where can we buy enough food for them to eat? And he does this to test Philip. And it says he knew what he was going to do all along. He knew what he was going to do, not that everybody was going to share their loaves. And then at the end of the gospel, this is the biggest proof that this is not simply a miracle of sharing. The biggest proof is that when the people saw the sign, they declared that this is the prophet, that this is the Messiah, that this is the new king. So you don't make a declaration like that if people are sharing. It just doesn't move people, that kind of reaction. So this is clearly a miraculous multiplication of loaves. Okay, so that's a divine action responding to a human need. Hunger, is indication of our limitation, of our need, of our dependence on God, and God provides. There's a lot of lessons here, but let's zero in on the participation that others have in this miracle. Jesus didn't simply make loaves appear. He didn't turn stones into bread. He took real barley loaves. Now, Philip, of course, when he was tested, said, well, we don't have enough money. That's the end of that question. No budget. And that's a pretty typical response. And we don't have enough money. Okay, got to raise money first. Andrew brings up this boy who has the 5 barley loaves and the 2 fish. And that's a step in the right direction. But again, it's limited by the natural perspective. What is 5 loaves for 5,000 people? Pretty much nothing. So let's focus on the boy himself, and he's the key figure here. 5 loaves is not nothing for a boy. And that's a lot of food. Why he had 5 loaves, I don't know. Maybe he was ready for, maybe his mother told him better bring extra, or who knows. But he has these loaves, and he makes them available to Jesus. And that's what Jesus uses to feed the crowd. So this boy's willingness to share what seems like nothing in the big picture, but not nothing to him, his willingness to share is what makes it possible for Jesus to do the miracle. And this is a very common way of pondering this gospel. The role of the boy, the faith, the leap of faith of the boy, the willingness to sacrifice on the part of the boy. He doesn't know what Jesus is going to do, but he's willing to release his control over his food, 5 loaves and 2 fish, and Jesus takes it from there. It's a reminder to us that we're not the ones who are going to solve the problems of the world, but we do have our little part to play, and we do have a few loaves. We do have something. We can back up even further. Where did the boy get those loaves? Well, somebody made them. Maybe his mother, maybe the local baker. And even back up further, where did his mother get the flour and the ingredients to make the loaves? Well, somebody grew barley and harvested it. And that maybe it was his father. Maybe it was the village, harvesters. And you can go back and say, well, who planted that barley? And where? And there's a lot of human participation in this that is so insignificant that we just don't even notice it, don't even think of it. But in God's perspective, it's all part of the miracle. He uses the little insignificant role of many, many people to produce these barley loaves, and they end up in the hands of this boy. He relinquishes them or surrenders them to Jesus. And then Jesus does an extraordinary miracle. You could say the same with the fish. Who caught those fish? Who dried them? Well, I don't know. It's not even mentioned. So why are you bringing it up? I'm bringing it up because it's a reminder to us of how very, seemingly very little things are part of how God works. Now, this is also an Anawim perspective. Anawim is very small. And Anawim people recognize how precious small things are, small, insignificant, littleness, helplessness, poverty. Why do the little ones, the poor, the helpless, why do they still have confidence that their little action, their little making their holy hour or praying their rosary or pondering the word can actually make any difference? Because of this principle, because it's God at work. And what seems insignificant to us is just our human perspective getting in the way of God. So who cares if we're big or small? That doesn't make any difference. Right? Just 1 loaf, 5 loaves, 10 loaves. No, 1 Hail Mary, 1 Our Father, 10 Hail Marys, 10 Our Fathers, 1 Rosary, 10 Rosaries. The people in Gaza don't know whether you're praying for peace. They don't know, and they don't maybe even care. But that's not the way to evaluate it. The way to evaluate it is to say, this is what I have, and what I have, I'm giving to you, and you do what You do, Lord. You use my barley loaves and feed the world. And that's a very great perspective to keep. It keeps up our hope, keeps up our awareness of our part in it. We're not just, not that, I mean, we're insignificant, but we're not useless. We're like leaven. The analogy is probably better to say leaven or the yeast. The yeast looks like nothing too. But without the yeast, you don't get the bread. Without these barley loaves, you don't get the miracle. Without our little participation, our acts of kindness, of generosity, of sacrifice, of prayer, we don't participate in the transformation of the world. So now this Easter time, we're talking about big, big changes, big power available. And it's not our power, but we have this seemingly small, but definitely significant role to play in the work of God to establish his kingdom. His kingdom, and to bring everybody into the kingdom of eternal life. So that's far beyond what Gamaliel is thinking, far beyond what Philip's thinking, far beyond what Andrew's thinking, even far beyond what the boy is thinking. But for people of faith, this isn't actually normal. That's why we keep going, because, gosh, there's no, for God, nothing's impossible. So let's keep giving him everything.